Hi, I'm Simon Smart from CPX, and you're listening to the Richard Johnson Lecture Series. In this episode, you'll hear Lisa Aitken's 2023 lecture titled Rediscovering Hope: How We Lost It, How We Get It Back. The future feels tenuous these days, uncertain, overwhelming even. Hope might be scarce, but it's not lost. At least not with Lisa Aitken as our guide. Lisa is a clinical psychologist with 25 years experience in her field, and she's just completed a PhD on hope. And in this lecture, she says we get 10 years of research in 45 minutes. For those feeling hopeful, and perhaps especially for those who are not, this is a great talk to hear. Hope from the perspective of psychology, philosophy, and theology. I hope you'll enjoy it.
It is a great honour to be presenting this year's Richard Johnson Lecture. I'll be presenting 8 years of research in 45 minutes, so we had best begin. Look, I've gone old school. I have paper and I even have an analogue watch to time myself. What is hope? 10 years ago, I started with this question, which really began out of curiosity in my clinical work. I could have two clients going through similar difficult circumstances, similar diagnoses, and yet one had something about how they saw the future which helped them flourish, and someone else would feel a bit more crushed. And I realised that what the person who was flourishing more had was more hope. And I thought, how do I work out how to help others have more hope? But what is hope? It's a word that we throw around all the time, but I needed to work out exactly what it was if I was going to bring it into the counselling room and help people have more of it. So I started asking my clients, my family, my friends, every dinner party we went to, my conversation starter was, how do you define hope? Seemed to work quite well. And I looked at the psychological literature, but psychology has only been looking at hope fairly recently. There wasn't a huge amount. Happily, I realised that for two millennia, philosophers and theologians have been writing about hope. And in fact, many of the great scholars, foundational in the West, had written extensively on it. So this was now my reading list. I started where you have two, with Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics. That's, you know, the beginning of the Western world. And moved my way through Augustine and Aquinas and Descartes and Kant and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, and then a whole lot of philosophical frameworks that are really hard to string in a sentence, but I'll give it a go. Existentialist, pragmatist, deconstruction theory, Marxist and analytic philosophers, and a whole array of theologians. So as you can imagine, this took nearly 2 years of just reading until my brain was just overflowing with thinking about hope. Luckily, it was hope and not despair. Now, extraordinarily, across these and the broader psychological research, there were four common themes that just kept coming up as part of the human experience of hoping. So I sort of extracted these and have turned them into a conceptualization, which I call common hope, and developed a measurement scale, a properly statistically validated measurement scale for it. And I used this in my research. Now, to make sure I was on the right track and this wasn't just a history of hope, I also asked many hundreds of Australians before the pandemic 2018 and during the pandemic 2020 about their experience of hope. And this four-factor concept seemed to work really well. As Simon said, hope is a timely topic. In fact, when I say to people, oh, I've just finished a thesis on hope, that's the most common thing they say, oh, good timely topic. And it is. We've had the pandemic. We've just had a divisive referendum. We have wars in Ukraine and now Israel and Gaza. All of this on top of long-standing climate issues, mental health crisis. The list goes on, doesn't it? It really is timely. And yet, when I did this big historical span, there were many points in human history where whole societies got very anxious, and where scholars then had a proliferation of writing about hope. So I'm going to introduce you to a few. This is Augustine, who wrote in the 4th century, In the middle of the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, this is a violent time. There's wars and there's pandemics. And he writes about earthly and spiritual hope. Fast forward 1,000 years, and we have Julian of Norwich in the 14th century. She is famous for her lines, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." She is writing her book, though, in the context of the bubonic plague, the Black Death. 1 in 3 people in Norwich had died when she was writing of the Black Death. There's also the Hundred Years' War going on. There's a peasant uprising all over the place, and there's natural disasters around her. Norwich is in flood. She actually herself, at the age of 30, was so sick with bubonic plague that she was given the last rites. She recovered, and after this was when she did her writing about hope, which is actually the first book that we have in English written by a woman. So she spent her days in a room in a church like the rest of her life. She was in voluntary lockdown, writing about hope and giving counsel to people who came to her window. Let's fast forward again to Germany. After the horrors of the concentration camps of World War II, not surprisingly, it's two Germans who start writing about hope. The top gentleman, Ernst Bloch, is a magnificent writer. He's an atheist, Marxist philosopher who wrote The Principle of Hope, which is like this thick. And Jürgen Moltmann is a theologian who, just after Bloch was writing, he wrote A Theology of Hope. He's a Christian theologian. And Moltmann says he's grappling with hope for those who have died, for the fallen, the gassed, the murdered, the disappeared. So all through history, hope has been a timely topic, hasn't it? But I do think there's two ways that our current society is distinctive in its need for hope. Back to Julian. Julian of Norwich was not in her room looking on her phone for the latest updates on how many people had died from the bubonic plague or were hospitalised. She wasn't looking at her laptop with live stream images of the Hundred Years' War in Europe. She wasn't getting constant negative analysis about the peasant uprisings or hearing from her friends on social media about how tough it was in the floods. But this is our world. We live inside 24/7, the live stream of tragic events happening all over the world. As humans, we're just not designed for this overload. Jonathan Haidt is a fantastic American social psychologist, and he speaks of this technological overwhelm, especially for young people, causing a sense of disempowerment. It's just too much. The other reason I think that we are struggling at the moment is we have lost the narratives that previous generations had to make sense of our lives and to give a vision for our future. Evidence of this is from my research in 2020. I asked Australians this question: what is your best realistic hope for humanity? And they had four options. Number one, I have no hope. Number two, my best hope is that things don't get worse. Number three, I have hope for a few generations, but after that, I'm not sure. Or number four, humans will flourish indefinitely. There was a really significant generational difference. The over 45s were far more likely to say, "We will flourish indefinitely." That was the most common answer. The under 25s were significantly more likely to say, "My best hope is that things don't get worse." What does that tell you if your best hope is things don't get worse? You've got a narrative of decline and you're just trying to stop it. Of course, what's probably behind this is fears about climate change. What are we doing to our planet? And we have a whole new diagnosis in psychology called eco-anxiety, and it's really impacting people. At a practical level, is things don't get worse a useful hope? I think it struggles to be, because there is no compelling vision of the future. It's just stop the rot. And we need a compelling vision of the future. Now, I'm aware I haven't actually defined hope. That was where we started 10 years ago. I was out looking for a hope scale, and I came to the psychological literature, and I found the scale which was used in nearly every piece of psychological and educational research. And I was actually really appalled. I thought, I am not willing to use this scale. This scale has two aspects, two components of hope. Number one, I have been successful at achieving my goals in the past. Number two, I can think of many ways to achieve my goals in the future. And that's it. That is hope, according to psychology. Now, I'm not saying they're irrelevant to hope. They've got a part to play. But for that to be the entirety seems so impoverished to me. What about if I've failed in the past? Isn't hope the one thing I've got in the future? Or what about if I have to hope in my surgeon or collective social action, like for climate change or in God? This pretty much sums it up. It's all about me. It's utterly individualistic. And unfortunately, it just confirms some really unhelpful and unhopeful aspects of our world. We have to broaden our understanding of hope. Now, just to clarify what I mean by hope, there is another pool of psychological research where they asked just, you know, everyday people, how do you differentiate hope from a bunch of other like similar words? So for example, I could say I hope to be a Jedi warrior. That's a fantasy. Hopes have to be, it's not a real fantasy that I have, but you know, in theory it's a fantasy. Hopes must be realistic. I hope for dessert. I always do hope for dessert. That's actually a want or a desire because hopes must be meaningful and noble. I hope to go to Pilates tomorrow morning. That would be a goal because hopes are quite uncertain. They're not in my full control and they normally involve waiting. And I could say I hope the weather is fine, but that is optimism. So optimism is passive. It's just a, yep, the future will be great. But if you hope for something, you have agency. You will act or recruit others to act so that you can make it happen. And through the history of all those scholars, they had three concentric circles. We have our personal hopes. These live within hope for humanity, which live within the bigger frame of our spiritual hopes. And we need to address all three. So I'm going to, for the rest of tonight, I'm going through the four aspects of hope. The good news is working on any one of those four will help you or whoever you're worried about have more hope, and they interact with each other in a sort of iterative way. So the first one is relationships. I have others I trust who can help. Hope exists best in sustaining relationships. It's not all about me. If you have ever been in a deep depression or know someone who has, you will know there are times that you have to borrow hope from other people. Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, said, "Love takes hope upon itself as the work of hoping for others." Now, I've chosen three pieces of research evidence for this, but there are so many. I've just plucked three out. In my own research, I asked people, and I wonder what you would answer for this, how many relationships do you have in which you feel you belong? And it was interesting looking at the results. Those who said they had none actually had almost no hope. But then as the number of relationships increased, so hope increased. And in case you're worried that you now have to have 100 relationships in which you feel you belong, at just 3 to 5, things started to improve. It's not that many, but you do need some. The second piece of evidence is research I did November 2020. So if you remember, do you remember 2020? You've probably blocked it from your memory as a trauma. But it was November, we'd just come out of lockdowns. We'd gone in March, we were coming out, and we thought we were done and dusted with COVID and it was all over and we didn't know what was coming. But I asked people, do you think you feel more or less hopeful now compared to before COVID and the lockdowns? And on average, people actually said a little bit more hopeful, which sort of makes sense. They were coming out of lockdowns. But one of the key things that they said was that in all that isolation of lockdowns, they'd realised how crucial their relationships were to them. And now as they emerged, they were really wanting to invest and they felt really hopeful about getting back into these relationships. The third piece of evidence comes from, strangely, an economist. Carol Graham is an American economist at a university, but she's been an advisor to the World Bank and IMF. And she does big scale economic research. And she wants hope to be used as a well-being metric in economics. Her research involved impoverished 18 to 21 year olds from very poor communities, but in three settings. Now, she tracks hope and relationships. She, of course, acknowledges there's other factors, but she does draw out the power of relationships to how hopeful these young people were. So she looks at really poor white American young people. These were the least hopeful out of the groups that she looked at. She says they have a strong ethos of individual effort. It's all about me, he's back. They were less likely to trust their neighbours. It's a bit of a worry, isn't it? And they had less parental support. More hopeful than them were also American, poor American young people, but these were from African American communities. They had more trust in their neighbours, more involvement in extended family and church, and they were significantly more hopeful even during the pandemic. But the most hopeful were in Peru, in incredibly poor contexts. But she said their community was extraordinary. It's a lot of involvement with extended family and church. And when people did well enough to leave the neighbourhood, they would come back and they would mentor the young people in, you know, sport or in life. And she said the richness of their relationships was actually more important to their hope than their financial poverty was. It had more of an impact. The final story about relationships is a personal one. A couple of years into my thesis, my husband Michael had a really bad bicycle accident. He was a mammal, a middle-aged male in Lycra, speeding around the streets of Sydney, until one day he was found unconscious, sprawled in the middle of the road, and we don't know what happened. He was a very experienced cyclist. He has amnesia for it, so we have no idea why that happened. But by the time I got to the hospital, he was in a coma. They didn't know if he would live or die. They said he's got a brain bleed. This could be permanent brain damage. And then they sent me home. They didn't let me stay. So, of course, I didn't sleep the entire night. And I was lying there. And the first half of the night, I'm praying for him, let him live, let him not be brain damaged, help the doctors, because I did have to put my hope in the doctors as well. And at about 2 in the morning, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm doing a thesis on hope. Do I have hope? I'm in the middle of this bizarre situation. Like, what does hope look like for me in this? And really, as I look to a potentially very difficult future, no matter what the outcome, my hope for myself and my children was in such a large part in the supportive, trusted, loving people around us. Our family, our friends, our church. Now, he did recover fully. It took nearly a year. He had smashed the whole left side of his body. I was going to put a photo up of the bruise, which went from like shoulder to knee, but it's pretty gory. I thought I'd better not do that to you. And he did have a traumatic brain injury, but he fully recovered over the year. And we were sustained in hope by the relationships. And some of you are here tonight who sustained us. Now, as you saw from my experience, it can be a relationship with the spiritual that we need when we hope. In my research data across the two pools that I did, I consistently saw that those who viewed spirituality as most important, the people who when I said, what do you do when you want to be more hopeful? If they volunteered, I would pray. That type of person was always significantly more hopeful. Now, I sort of knew this would come because there is a truckload of psychological literature on the relationship between spirituality and hope, and indeed on spirituality and well-being in general. It is important to say, though, that not all spirituality is associated with flourishing. So other research, especially by Ken Pargament, has clearly shown this. Of course, spirituality characterized by abuse or manipulation or coercion or even just done because of social pressure hasn't got anything much to do with well-being, is damaging and at times tragic rather than healthy. The type of spirituality that is healthy in the psych literature is always freely chosen and involves positive, trusting relationships, including with the divine. An example of the positive impact of healthy spirituality was found in the Human Flourishing Program at Harvard University. They were looking at deaths of despair. This is a catch-all for people who die from substance abuse, like, you know, the opioid crisis in the States, and suicide. You can die from lack of hope. So they were exploring deaths of despair, and they found that people who went to church regularly, who were in that faith community, were five times less likely to die from deaths of despair than those who didn't. The salutary point from this whole piece on relationships is that if you want to increase hope, nurture relationships of belonging and invest in spiritual engagement. The second aspect that we will look at is waiting well. I can cope and be poised to act. In our fast-paced society, we struggle to wait. We have no time for patience. I don't know about you. If I'm trying to load a website on my phone and it's just a little bit slow, I can feel the frustration rising. Think, what has happened to my patience? But when hard times come, our capacity to wait well, to cope and be poised to act, is really crucial. In the 3rd century, Tertullian said, hope is patience with the lamp lit. It's a great image, isn't it? Poised to act, but being patient. This is the beautiful Torres Strait. We have good friends who are Torres Strait Islanders. We go up there for holidays. And when we go up, if I can, I like to fish, sitting in a dinghy in the channel with a line out. And this particular year, I was sitting there waiting for the trevally or the mackerel or whatever's going to emerge. It was a long time. To be honest, I'd sort of given up hope. And so I got the line and I was doing between my fingers this lovely macrame piece. Now, those of you who fish know where this is going, because it wasn't a little mackerel that got my bait. It was a shark. And it, you know, it yanked my bait and pulled the line, and it took years for the scars from the cuts on my fingers to heal. And I thought, life lesson on waiting well and not being distracted. I should have been poised with my line on the lookout for catching my fish. So how we cope in these times matters. We have many coping strategies available to us, but as the philosopher Charles Taylor has said, freedom of choice is only valuable insofar as we choose well. So in 2020, I did research what coping choices actually correlate with hope. Let's start with what doesn't work. Mindless distraction, like this. We call it avoidance coping. And you'll know it. Endless hours on screens, phone games, binge watching TV, YouTube scrolling, comfort eating, comfort drinking. Now, look, we all do it to a point, but there are some people where those things are their go-to coping strategies. And they're easy, aren't they? That's the big advantage. We slide into them. But they're just distraction. They're not keeping you poised and ready to act. Now, actually, if you're struggling with hope, they're going to make you feel more hopeless. So what does work? Well, coping well is hoping well. Approach coping is what we call it. Talking to supportive people, journaling your feelings, mindfulness, prayer, exercise, creative hobbies. In the 13th century, Aquinas said that hope is a stretching out to the good. And these coping strategies like this, you know, exercise, looking after your body, looking after your mind, they in themselves are you stretching out to the good. They're good for you and they're going to keep you alert and they're going to keep you ready to act to bring about the hopes that you're wanting. I recently had a client who arrived with a diagnosis of stage 3 cancer, and the first session he sat down and he said, I don't think I have any hope. I'm waiting for surgery. I have no hope. And I said, what are you doing in the meantime, in the waiting? What are you doing to cope? And he said, well, I'm trying to talk to family members. I'm trying to eat well and exercise. And I'm reading stories of other people with this cancer who, you know, their experiences and what helped. And I said, you are hoping. If you are coping that well, that is a sign you are hoping. And we can have eyes to see this and look at it in yourself. If you're doing a good job of looking after yourself, that is a sign you have hope. So the summary of this one is that effort into waiting well with good coping is actually a sign you are hoping. The third point is to do with possibilities. I believe the future can be meaningful. So a sense that the future offers meaningful possibilities is a crucial antidote to despair. There's two types of roadblocks to possibility thinking. The first might be a bit surprising, but it's some of the assumptions of our society, some of the air that we just breathe. Do you remember I said I started the historical reading looking at the Greco-Roman world, Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, and I was really shocked when I read them because in the classical world, hope was not a virtue. No one wanted hope. We're crying out for it. They didn't want it because hope requires possibilities. And possibilities require change. And in the Greco-Roman world, especially for the Stoics, the world goes through endless cycles of repetition. There is no ultimate change. And their society is in a fixed hierarchy. So Aristotle writes, if you're a slave, don't hope to be anything other than a slave. Stay where you are. This is the good. And societies with a strong sense of sort of fate like this are less likely to privilege hope. Because to hope, we have to value change. In our Western society, we have a different view of time. We see time as having a beginning and an anticipated end, and in between, there's vast amounts of who knows what will happen. It's possibilities and change. And this more linear view is from the Judeo-Christian narrative that we have. It's the legacy of it, really, that we have in our society. So we think hope is important because change is important. The second roadblock is individual. And there's two common issues that both narrow our possibility thinking, right? To hope, we have to be able to think of many possibilities. But when this gets narrowed, it's a problem. So the first one is anxiety. You all know fight, flight, freeze. It goes on, you experience a threat and it's designed for a sort of a physical threat. This goes on in your body. But what goes on in your brain is really interesting. Your prefrontal cortex here has all your possibility thinking. But if you're under a threat, an imminent physical threat, you don't want to be thinking about wonderful possibilities about the rest of your life. You want to just think of the worst case scenario. What if I'm about to be attacked? So this part of your brain goes offline. We say your lid has flipped, if that's that part of your brain, which is fine if you're being attacked and not very good if your stress is from screens, from work stress, from relationship stress. Our stresses are chronic and cumulative, but our brains still have this response. And so a lot of us are spending a lot of time thinking about worst case scenarios and not doing good possibility thinking. The take-home message here is any work you do to calm anxiety is going to help you with hope. So breathing, mindfulness, exercise, you know those things which are going to calm you, even if they're physical. Like people get surprised that breathing is going to help them be more hopeful, but it will because it will. This can come back online. Your prefrontal cortex comes back online when you calm down and you can think again. The second roadblock is addiction. Last year I did a year-long addiction medicine course. This is very much in my mind. So over the last 20 years, the type of addictions I've seen in my practice have changed. Of course, any addiction narrows your thinking, doesn't it? You become really focused on it, and that is the case. But recently, there are two types of addiction I'm seeing, especially in young people. The first is social media and technology addiction, gaming addiction, and the second is sugar and ultra-processed food addiction. For the first time, I'm having parents with safes in their kitchens for the food and in their living room for the devices because they cannot necessarily, you know, kids can't manage themselves and the parents have to do it for them. Now, if you think about it, both what's going on in our devices and the food is designed to be addictive intentionally by the manufacturers, hello corporate greed, and too much of either of those, of the sugar or the social media, independently correlates with increasing anxiety and depression. But for those who are addicted, when you wake up in the morning, you're not thinking about all the possibilities, you're just thinking, How many likes did I get on that post? What's my next level in the game? When's my next sugar hit? And it really narrows the possibilities. So managing these addictions, but it can be any addiction, is really important in managing hope. We need these possibilities to be meaningful to give us hope. Hope isn't rose-coloured glasses. Some of you probably have read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning about hope in the concentration camps. There's a lot of research about hope in palliative care literature and about its connection with meaning. How do you and I experience meaning? Roy Baumeister and his colleagues did some really interesting research looking at what makes people meaningful. And they got some data about how often people were thinking about the past or the present or the future. What they found was that people who spend a lot of time focused on the present, like lots of mindfulness, were happier than other people. But this came at a cost. They found life less meaningful. The people who found life most meaningful thought sort of evenly about the past and the present and the future. And these researchers say this created a narrative arc, a story of their lives in which they felt they lived. Now, for hope, how we think about the future end of that narrative arc really matters. And the type of ending we anticipate for humanity matters for us, because if you hadn't noticed, we are humanity. It will be us. Now, one of the fun things about doing a thesis on hope is my friends send me all sorts of hope paraphernalia. So I've got hope magnets, and I've got, you know, there's words with, you know, hope in wood written as a like a house decoration, hope wine. I've got a necklace with hope. And they send me books. I say, look, this is a really good book about hope. So one of my friends said, you need to read this. It's a book about hope. And it was fascinating. So chapter one, this is what Mark Manson says about his view of the narrative arc of humanity. One day, you and everyone you love will die. And beyond a small group of people, for an extremely brief period of time, little of what you say or do will ever matter. And everything you think or do is an elaborate avoidance of it. We are but inconsequential cosmic dust bumping and milling around on a tiny blue speck. We imagine our own importance. We invent our purpose. We are nothing. And he's not being facetious. He doesn't believe in any sort of spiritual framework. It's like the self-help version of Nietzsche. But for him, the ultimate hope is to upload our brains onto an AI supercomputer, for those who can afford it, I guess. So even if we've destroyed the Earth, our brain algorithms can live on. And Yuval Noah Harari in Homo Deus has a similar hope for humanity. This is like a serious endeavour, because if there is no spiritual framework, we have to find hope somehow. As humans, we're driven to find hope. Now, I know some of my friends think, well, yes, this is mature and brave. It abandons the childish sort of fantasies of religion, and it leans in on technology. Now, the truth or otherwise of this view is, like, that's bigger than tonight. But my question is much more simple. Does that lead to hope? Is this really a book about hope? Well, some evidence from my research would suggest no. So I asked people this question. How much do you put your trust in the following for the future of humanity? Government, evolutionary progress, those with money or power, the belief that good will conquer evil, science, the belief that things happen for a reason, artificial intelligence, inherited wisdom and traditions, God or a higher power, younger generation, collective action, older generation. There were heaps of choice. I actually had no idea really how people were going to respond, but trust in science, like in hindsight, I thought, yes, of course, was the most common answer that people put their trust in for the future of humanity. But the really interesting thing was trust in science was not associated with hope. These people didn't feel that hopeful. And I thought, well, antibiotics, nuclear warfare, you know, I can sort of see that. But interestingly, trust in AI didn't correlate with hope, and nor did trust in evolution alone. Only three did, and bearing in mind that my sample was pretty representative of the Australian population in terms of spiritual frameworks. So the first one that correlated with hope was God or a higher power. Unsurprising, I've already said there's a lot of research that suggest this. But the other two I hadn't expected. So the only other two that correlated with hope were the belief that good will conquer evil and the belief that everything happens for a reason. Now, in the framework that Manson represents, it's entirely up to humans for good to conquer evil. From the violence of the fall of Rome to modern Gaza, Israel, and the war, the human track record doesn't really give us much hope that good is going to conquer. And in his framework, it's not that we can't know the reason for things, it's that there is no reason for things. There is no purpose. So I think in order to believe those two, you have to have some sort of spiritual framework. You do have to look beyond humanity. And these two beliefs are very similar to the end of the Christian narrative, the Christian story. Now, we've already noticed that the Judeo-Christian framework is a foundational one in our society, so perhaps this is not that surprising. Now, I'm not saying, of course, that you need to be a Christian to believe those two things. I'm just saying a likely origin story for why they're very common beliefs is the Christian heritage that we're living in. So what is the hoped-for future in the Christian narrative? Well, good does conquer evil. There we go. God steps in at the end to make things right, including to judge evil. There's a time when we fully understand the purpose of it all, the reason. And the Christian view is that at this time, God restores this beautiful earth in what is called in the Bible the new creation. So our now devastated environment is restored. The coral gets its colour back and the Amazon is bursting with life. Now, of course, we need to be working now to care for this creation we're entrusted with. But in the Christian narrative, God steps in at the end to do his part. And I think we probably need him the way we're going. And in this hoped-for future, human culture is redeemed as well. There's images in the Bible of a community of peace and joy. Personally, I became a Christian as an adult, but I had quite a few years as a Christian when I still thought, oh, when you die, you just sort of, I don't know, go off somewhere out there. I hadn't realized this is a restored and renewed earth. This is our familiar, beautiful earth and us and our culture. I think it's really exciting. And Christian faith looks backwards to the past bit of our narrative arc as the reality base, to the historical record of Jesus and his power over nature and ultimately his resurrection, because what God did for Jesus in giving him a transformed body is what he will do for humans and for the world. It is an embodied and relational hope. It's got some grounds in the past. To me, it feels much more right than my brain uploaded onto a machine eternally. Jürgen Moltmann, the German theologian I mentioned earlier, who wrote after World War II, captures this. He says the ultimate reason for our hope is not to be found at all in what we want, wish for, and wait for. The ultimate reason is that we are wanted and wished for and waited for. Does anything await us at all, or are we alone? Whenever we base our hope on trust in the divine mystery, we feel deep down in our hearts there is someone who is waiting for you, someone who is hoping for you, who believes in you. We are waited for as the prodigal son in the parable is waited for by his father. God is our last hope, but we are God's first love. So the summary of this section: to keep possibility thinking open, we need to manage anxiety and addiction. To reflect on meaning, we need to think about past, present, and future. And perhaps go home and ponder, what do you put your trust in for the future of humanity? Because that is you. The final section, and this is short, is glimpses. I have eyes to see, glimpses to give me feelings of hope. Hope has always been an emotion. Through history, it's been described as a passion. So we need an aspect that acknowledges this. Now, this is a beautiful tropical island. And I'm going to do something very risky at this time of night. I'm going to get you to close your eyes just for like 10 seconds. And if the person next to you nods off, elbow them. Because what I want you to do is just close your eyes. I would like you to imagine you are on a tropical island. You have been exhausted in your work up until then. And you've really needed a holiday. You feel the warm sand between your toes. You hear the water lapping and there's a cool breeze and there's no responsibilities for the whole day ahead. Okay, open your eyes. Just check, is the person next to you got their eyes open? You didn't need the whole itinerary of the holiday, I hope, just to get a little taste of how relaxing that is. And isn't that motivating? You know, you probably want to rush out tomorrow morning now and book a tropical holiday. These researchers, Seligman and Baumeister and others, argue that as humans, we should be called the Homo prospectus because this thing that we do of being able to imagine the future is really unique and we do it all the time. We think about the future actually 2 to 3 times more than we think about the past. And they report a mix of neuroscience and other research that whenever we imagine the future like you imagine that holiday, it actually creates a more intense emotional response inside your brain, in your neural circuitry, than when you remember the past. And it's sort of disproportionately powerful to get a glimpse of the future. So our brains seem to be designed so when we imagine our hopeful future, just a little taste, it pulls backwards to our present so we get this little feeling, they call it automatic affect, and then that pushes us forward and you say, yes, I want to make that happen. I want to make the holiday happen to bring about the full-blown hope that we were anticipating. So I just want to clarify what this visualizing these glimpses is not. This is not ours fantasizing about winning the lottery because hope has to be realistic and we just need a little glimpse. And this isn't like visualizing to put it out into the universe that it'll happen. It's visualizing so you get a taste and are motivated to keep going, bring it about. So we can use our imagination just to get a glimpse of what we hope for. And this is a really good thing to do. It keeps us feeling hopeful. But we also can have eyes to see tangible glimpses in our real life. I had a client last year who has a son with level 3 autism. So he's really quite disabled. She's his full-time carer. And he's going to go into respite, but not yet. She has to wait. And she's actually exhausted. She adores him, but she's exhausted. And she's saying, how can I keep going until this respite? And we talked about that every time she goes onto her deck with a cup of tea, to just see this as a tangible glimpse of the rest she will have when she's in respite. It's about how you frame it. It's having eyes to see the little good things in your life as tastes of a bigger hope. Another example would be when I do relationship counselling. Sometimes couples, even though I try hard to make this not happen, I've got some colleagues here, this doesn't happen very often, but sometimes couples argue in the session and it's pretty intense and I had to buy myself a really big leather chair with like studs down it so I could swivel and say, stop arguing, stop talking, use, you know, go. Just to make myself a bit more intimidating. But sometimes they're in the middle of an argument and they start laughing. There's just some, you know, common understanding that happens. And I say, hold that moment. That's the glimpse of where you're going to go, where you want to go, where you hope to go, the glimpse of common understanding. So it's having eyes to see these, not just as pleasant times in the present, but that they push forward to something we hope for in the future. Finally, we can not only imagine what we hope for or notice the glimpses, but we can be the glimpse of hope. I'm sure many of you know of this man, Tony Rinaldo. He's an Australian agronomist who has made a profound difference to reforestation in Niger in Africa. He and his wife went to plant trees in the Sahara in the 80s, but few of these trees survived. And then he realised that in areas where the trees had been decimated, there's nothing much above the ground, their roots were still underground. This is the forest underground. And he was seeing the glimpses of the little shoots of these trees come up. And he said, we don't have to plant whole new trees. We just have to nurture the ground and new trees will emerge. And he's worked now for decades with African communities. And farmers are using it to restore ruined land and reduce food insecurity. And he's deservedly won a lot of awards. Don't you think he is a glimpse of hope as a person? He says in his book, "In the face of environmental destruction and injustice, my journey started with a child's prayer, asking God to use me somehow, somewhere, to make a difference." Now, reforesting Africa sets a high bar, doesn't it, for us to be the glimpse. But we all have things that are deeply meaningful to us in our communities where you and I can be the glimpse of hope. And remember, these glimpses are disproportionately powerful in giving us hope. Now, I have many friends here tonight. Thank you so much for joining. Many of you have been glimpses of hope for me, and I'm just going to pick three. Dawn, our friend, is here. She wins the prize for the person who's travelled the most. She came from Cairns. And for years, she posted seeds each fortnight from her tropical fruit orchard up in Cape Tribulation to women in the Congo in Africa. And during times of conflict, the fruit from the seed sent from a little farm in Australia was often their main source of food. The second group I've got here are friends from the ocean paddling community. In the terrible fires of the summer before COVID, I found this so inspiring. They raised money, they went down to the fire-ravaged south coast of New South Wales to install water tanks for households just off their own bat. Isn't that a glimpse of hope? Michael, my husband, and some friends set up a few years back their own refugee charity to help settle 10 Syrian refugee families on the northern beaches and help them integrate in our community. They're doing really well, and Michael's here, and Samira, a beautiful friend who lived with us, is here. There are so many other stories, and they certainly fill me with hope, with people being the glimpses of hope. So this is where we've been. They're in a different order just to keep you on your toes. I wonder out of all of this talk, and I know 45 minutes is a long time these days, isn't it, to listen, which one stood out most for you? Perhaps pick one now and ponder it on the way home and think about something you can do yourself, whether it's to do with relationships, spiritual relationships, people, coping, possibilities, or these glimpses. And my hope is that these reflections tonight have provided a glimpse of hope for each of you. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to the 2023 Richard Johnson Lecture delivered by Lisa Aitken. Lisa is a clinical psychologist who's been counselling and teaching for more than 25 years in workplaces, hospitals, and private practice. She recently completed a PhD on the shifting grounds of hope through Western history in philosophy, theology, and psychology. Please also check out our other podcast, Life and Faith. It's a weekly conversation about the beauty and complexity of belief in the 21st century. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to know more about CPX, our website is publicchristianity.org.